pleasure to introduce once again Vermont Brew from Old Brew Academy, and we've been a visiting fellow here this term, and who many of you know, and don't need an introduction to. Today, last time he spoke on a project he has finished in a way, I don't know if he continues to work on it or not, but the work Radha Tantra that he completed, published, and today he'll be talking about his current project and his current research in Hari Bhakti Vilasa, the meeting of Vedic Tantric and Puranic rituals. So I'm very much forward to hearing more about that.
Thank you very much indeed. I always hate when people begin their talks by saying, this is a work in progress. But unfortunately, that's exactly what this is. It is, just as Dr. Nitya Harms told us. This is what I'm working on right now. A text called the Hari Bhakti Vilas.
Sorry.
I tried to be a little bit subtle.
I thought you were making a point.
This text goes under two names. Bhagavad Bhakti Vilas or Hari Bhakti Vilas. Similar to, for example, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which I believe originally also was called Bhagavad Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Written around 1534, in some of the printed editions of this text, there's a verse at the end saying that it was finished in Nandagrama, in the Vraja area, that year. However, I haven't been able to find that verse in any of the manuscripts, so I'm not sure about that. But we can be certain about more or less this year, because this text is cited by Rupa Goswami in a book from 1541. So it needs to be at least a little bit older than that. It consists of 20 chapters, or vilasas. Maybe you can take out the book there so people can see. It's a huge book, as you can see. About 12,000 Anushtubh verses, divided into chapters of usually about 350 verses, but some very much longer. The longest one is about 1,000 verses. The nature of the book is that it's what is called a Nibandha on sadachara, or good behavior, correct behavior of the ideal Vaishnava devotee. So the book will describe everything, almost everything, from how to get up from your bed in the morning, how to brush your teeth, how to go about your morning duties, all through the day, then all through the different events of the fortnight, then the different events of the month, and then the different events of the months of the year. And then at the end also, just in case, if you would like to build a temple, install an image, rules for that as well. And that it is a Nibandha means that it doesn't just present these rules. If it did that, then the text would probably be maybe less than a tenth in length of what it is now. Rather, what it does is that it will say, do this, and then it will back up that statement with citations from earlier texts, where there's a certain hierarchy. The prime authority of the text, unsurprisingly for a Gaudiya Vaishnava text, is the Bhagavata Purana. But the text cites a great many different authorities, maybe up to around 200 different sources. And once it has established that something should be done, it will it will deliberate on whether this thing is a duty that is nitya, that means mandatory. Almost all of the things presented in the book are stated to be nitya kriyas, mandatory duties, daily duties. And then after that, there will be a mahatmya. Mahatmyas, of course, well known for Puranic scholars particularly. A mahatmya is a collection of statements describing all of the great things that will follow from doing particular observance. The Haribhakti Vilasa does this with everything that is presented. When it speaks about cleaning the temple in the morning before doing the puja, it says that the floor should be wiped with a mixture of cow dung and water and clay spread out on the floor. And if you do that, then you will go to heaven for as many years, as many hundreds and thousands of years as there are drops of water in that mixture. And every single thing that you do will be described like this in these mahatmyas. If you don't do it, then you are no better than a dog, and you're destined for hell. If you do it, then wonderful things will happen. So scholars have often been not very interested in these kind of mahatmyas. They have just seen these kind of overly eulogistic descriptions of whatever. And they're often quite formulaic, just as I've been describing to you. But oftentimes they also tell us something about the underlying theology of the text. And in the Haribhakti Vilasa, this is often true. The author will sometimes group these Mahatmya verses in groups. Will say that if you do this, then firstly, this thing, let's say meditating on the form of Vishnu, that will free you from your sins. And then there'll be another section of verses saying that this will liberate you from samsara. And then there'll be a further section saying that this will also be pleasing to the Lord, Bhagavat. So you see this idea common in Gaudiya Vaishnava texts of there being some kind of a post-liberated bhakti, bhakti that continues on the other side of moksha. So these mahatmya sections can sometimes be just a few verses, sometimes up to 100 verses. For example, the observance of bathing outside in the month of Magha, it's January, February. Even in India, that can be quite cold before the sun goes up in the morning. 100 verses describing all the great things that will happen if you do that. So all of this makes the book quite long, and honestly, sometimes rather tedious to read. And that is, I think, one reason for why this book hasn't been very much studied by scholars of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. There are many Nibandha, Dharma Nibandha texts like this, and none of them have really been much studied by scholars. Especially in Bengal, many texts like this were compiled, where the author would combine material from older texts to bring out some new ideas. And when I gave the heading for this talk as being the Haribhakti Vilasa as a meeting point of Vedic, Tantric, and Puranic ritualism, what I really wanted to show with that was how many things combine in this book. There's a very strong idea of trying to come across as Brahminically orthodox, if you wish, or orthopractic, better. In many cases, the author will include Vedic hymns to be chanted when eating and bathing. But now and then, new ideas will come in. For example, when describing gurus, the author will, in common with similar texts, say that the guru should be a Brahmin. That's stated several times in this particular section. But then he will also say that more important than the guru being a Brahmin is that the guru should be a Vaishnava. So there's kind of an opening to something new here. And we'll see that in a little while, how that develops. So what I've done so far, this project, is that I have collected the various printed editions of the text. There are about 5 printed editions. And then I have looked at manuscripts of this text in different places of India and abroad. I've looked at about 80 manuscripts. I'll explain the reason for this division, 65 plus 14 later. I don't have copies of all of them. I wasn't always allowed to take copies, but I've looked at all of these, and I have copies of most of them. And I've examined all of them, and I've chosen out of this amount, I've chosen 12 that I will use for collating the critical text. My choice here has been based on age. I tried to pick the oldest manuscripts. But more, also importantly, I tried to pick manuscripts in different parts of India. This text was written in North India, in the Vrindavan area, but it has spread all the way up to the Punjab, and then east to Bangladesh, and southeast to Orissa. And there are stray manuscripts in other places as well. I found one in Malayalam script in Kerala, and there are some in Assam as well. So it's spread fairly wide. And I'm going to show you just a few pictures of what these manuscripts look like. This is the oldest one that has a date that I've been able to find. Unfortunately, I haven't found any very old manuscripts. The text was written about 1540, remember? So this is about 200 years after. This is from Jaipur, a text in Devanagari script. It's actually in quite good condition. It's only the first folio that is damaged. It's fairly... The scribe hasn't been very attentive, but nevertheless, it's an important manuscript. This one I got by the assistance of the Bhaktivinoda Research Center in Kolkata. This one is digitalized from a library in Patna, but it was actually written in Karoli in Rajasthan. And it's also dated. Most of the manuscripts are not dated, unfortunately, but many of them are. 1770, so almost the same age. Also Devanagari, as you can see, but much clearer, much more carefully written. Not many mistakes in this one. This one is also in good condition. Again, and as very often, the first folio is damaged. But otherwise, it's in good condition. This one is from the State Museum of Orissa in Bhuvaneshwar. It was copied in the Kujanga area of Orissa in 1770. And it's in Bengali script, kind of old-fashioned Bengali script. But this one is interesting because it's the only one where the scribe has made notes in the margin. We'll come to a commentary that often accompanies this text, but in this manuscript, the scribe has made his own comments, usually in brackets like this, and then it took a while for me to learn how to read it, but after a while you start noticing signs like that. That means that there's a note somewhere nearby. Unfortunately, most of the notes are not very helpful. If the text says Vipra, then there'll be a note Brahmana, which isn't that hard to figure out. But sometimes these notes are of interest. Here's another Devanagari one from Vrindavana, from the Jiva Institute in Vrindavana. A neat Devanagari one. And here's another from in Bengali letters from Kolkata. This one is interesting because it belongs to a famous family. The family of Rajendra Lal Mitra. Maybe some of you have heard about him. He was a secretary for the Oriental Society, in Royal Asiatic Society in Calcutta. He has a street named after him in Kolkata, and a big ancestral house. And his grandfather, according to the colophon, copied this, or had this text copied. And here you can see that we have the mula, or the main text, here in the middle, and then a commentary on top and underneath. This text is often accompanied by this commentary. More than half of the manuscripts have the commentary. Different manuscripts, catalogs, will say that this manuscript has a commentary by this person or that person. But every manuscript that has a commentary always has the same commentary. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. So, press once more. There are some puzzling questions about this book. The first is with regard to its authorship. The book itself says right at the beginning that it was written by Prabodhanandasya Shishyu Bhagavat Priyasya, by the disciple of Prabodhananda, dear to the Lord, called Gopala Bhatta. So it says very clearly that this book was written by Gopala Bhatta, and at the chapter colophon, at the end of every chapter, it will say Iti Sri Bhagavad Bhakti Vilase Gopala Bhatta Vilikite. So it will say at the end of every chapter that this was written by Gopala Bhatta. Nevertheless, Jiva Goswami, who was a contemporary of Gopala Bhatta, in his Laghu Vaishnava Toshani, he lists the works of his uncle Sanatana Goswami, and he mentions Hari Bhakti Vilas as one of those works. So he says that this book was written by Sanatana Goswami. And Krishnadasa Kaviraja, in his Chaitanya Charitamrita, a little bit later, he also says on two different occasions that the Hari Bhakti Vilasa was written by Sanatana Goswami. And he also has Sri Chaitanya Dev explain about the book that Sanatana Goswami is going to write, which has exactly the same contents as the Hari Bhakti Vilasa. So we have two very different opinions here about who wrote this book. We've heard that the karma nirnaya,
karma adhikara nirnaya,
karma adhikara
nirnaya, karma vritti as well.
Yes, two books of the 17th century from Jaipur. They also refer to the Hari Bhakti Vilasa as being written by Sanatana Goswami. So the later Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition has tried to reconcile this somehow. They proposed different solutions. One is that Gopala Bhatta, out of his great humility, told everybody that this book was written by Sanatana Goswami. Just like he is supposed to have told Krishnadas Kaviraj not to mention his name in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Such a thing, of course, wouldn't be impossible, considering the very strong stress on humility in the Vaishnava tradition. However, if that was his desire, then it's somewhat surprising that he mentioned his own name in the book. So, maybe not the best explanation. Another explanation proffered is that Sanatana Goswami wrote the main verses, and Gopala Bhatta was the one who did kind of the hard work then of putting in all the citations. But there's no evidence of this in the book itself. In the beginning of the book, the author says that he wrote it to please Rupa and Sanatana and Raghunatha Dasa Goswamis. So it seems that it's something that he wrote himself and then presented to these others. Others have offered different solutions as well. OVL Kapoor, a scholar and practitioner scholar of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, told me several years back when I met him that Sanatana Goswami first wrote a short book called the Hari Bhakti Vilasa on the lines of what he had heard from Chaitanya Deva, and then later on Gopala Bhatta expanded that book into the huge book we see today. And he offered as proof of this the fact that there are some manuscripts of a shorter Hari Bhakti Vilasa in different libraries in India. He told me this in, I think, 1994 or something like this. I think he had borrowed the idea himself from earlier authors. Nevertheless, now when I looked at the different manuscripts, of course I was interested to see whether there is such a shorter version anywhere. And indeed there is. If you remember the 65 plus 14 manuscripts, the 14 are manuscripts of the shorter Hari Bhakti Vilasa. However, the shorter manuscripts are clearly abbreviations of the longer one rather than the other way around, because they're always called Samkshipta or Sarudhara or something like this. And even those, the shorter ones, they always, without any exception, ascribe to Gopala Bhatta. So this solution either doesn't really work. Another mystery of the text is who wrote the commentary, because there is, as I mentioned, this commentary that often accompanies the main text. It's anonymous, it doesn't mention its author anywhere, and it also seems to be incomplete. It covers all the 20 chapters, but it ends about three-fourths into the last chapter, in all the manuscripts as well. So maybe the name was mentioned at the end and the last folio got lost at some time. We don't know. Maybe the author passed away before he finished it. The commentary, at any rate, is clearly written after the main text, because it quotes some texts not written when the main text was written. It's traditionally ascribed to Sanatana Goswami. That would make it one of his later works. Maybe Gopala Bhatta wrote the main text first and then Sanatana Goswami wrote the commentary on it sometime later, maybe 10 years later. And it's possible then that his having written the commentary was then mixed up with his having written the whole text. Maybe like this. Or in some kind of cooperation. We don't know exactly. And unfortunately, so far in my study of this text, I haven't been able to find a definite answer. Another question, of course, is why was this text written? Because it seems very different from many other Gaudiya Vaishnava texts. One explanation, often proffered by modern Gaudiya Vaishnavas, is that this text was written to placate the smartas, to make them realize that the Vaishnavas are not just sentimental dreamers or radicals and levelers or anything like that, but strict ritualists. If that is what you want to do, you don't want to write a huge book like this. You'd write a small pamphlet that could easily be distributed. There's more to the text than that. I'll come back to this question a little bit later. I mentioned that the book cites more than 200 earlier works. However, when you look closely at the citations given in the book, you realize that the author hasn't always had access to the books that he is quoting. Sometimes he will give rather exact citations. He will say that in the Padma Purana, in the section concerning the month of Vaishakha, in the conversation between Narada and Ambarisha, this verse is found. And when he does that, usually you'll find these versions in the printed editions of these texts available today. In other cases, he'll just say Skandi, Padme, Brahmi, Indaskanda, Padma, so on, Puranas. And in those cases, you seldom find these verses anywhere. Especially when it comes to the Brahma Vaivarta Purana. There must be at least 200 verses from the Brahma Vaivarta Purana given in the Haribhakti Vilasa. Not a single one of those can be found in the extant Brahma Vaivarta Purana. Because this Purana is a text that has been heavily reworked sometime maybe in the 17th century. The older Brahma Vaivarta Purana is completely different from the one we have today. So in many cases, the author has not had access directly to the books that he's quoting, but he's quoting them from somebody else, taking them on somebody else's authority. And these books that he uses for this, he sometimes mentions, sometimes not. For example, in the first chapters where he deals with guru and initiation, he mentions some of his sources. The Kramadipika, which is a book on ritual, today at least associated with the Nimbarka Sampradaya, written in probably in the 15th century. An important source for him. Another important source is the Narasingha Paricharya, written by somebody called Krishna Deva Acharya. A book we don't know very much about, focusing on the worship of Narasimha, the man-lion, but with very devotional elements as well, speaking about Prima Bhakti and so on. So this is something that I'm working on right now, finding out exactly what books the author had on his desk, so to speak, when he wrote. What kind of library did he use? We know that from other work about the Vrindavana Goswamis, that they did have a fairly large manuscript library. Parts of that are preserved today in the Vrindavan Research Institute. But unfortunately, we don't have a catalogue in that institute of exactly which books belonged to which era. So this is something that I'm working with right now. What kind of books does he make use of? And an interesting result that I've come across already is that the breadth of books that he uses is much larger than you would expect of a Vaishnava. He uses tantric texts such as the Sharada Tilaka heavily. He uses texts from South India. Not very many, but he's well aware of Vedanta Deshika, for example. He uses some Pancharatra texts, not many, but a few. And he's well aware of the Smarta texts of Bengal as well, Krishnadeva and so on. So there's a lot of different kinds of texts that he's using. Mainly Vaishnava texts, but not only Vaishnava texts. And Vaishnava texts from many different traditions as well. So, what are then the places of Veda and Tantra in Gaudiya Vaishnavism? In the commentary, the commentator will often say, in the beginning of the text, when he needs to explain everything, he will explain these Mahatmya passages by referring to Mimamsa. Because in one sense, it's strange to have a Mahatmya if something's mandatory. Usually, Mimamsa will say that if something is nitya, so if a duty is mandatory, then you'll incur a penalty, a sin or an offense by not performing it. But if you perform it, then that's just what you're supposed to do. You'll not get anything from that. But the commentator will say that yes, but in some cases, such as the Darsha Paurnamasa sacrifice, we will see in the scriptures that even though it's a mandatory observance, still it will have its own mahatmya. It will still have its own benefits. Now this is a strange example because, of course, during the time when the Haribhakti Vilas was written, nobody performed any Darsha Paurnamasa sacrifices, or very few. Nevertheless, this example is a classic example of Mimamsa exegesis. So the author is clearly familiar with this kind of scriptural exegesis and wanted to align himself with that. In some places he also includes Vedic hymns that are to be recited in the ordinary way, just mentioning the first couple of words. Will not give the whole hymn, we'll just say that. Then the Apohishta hymn, then the whatever. So he finds a need to include Vedic material, which is maybe a little bit surprising, given how little of Veda there is anywhere else in the Gaudiya Vaishnava corpus. There's also very much, as I mentioned, of Tantra in the Haribhakti Vilasa. Explicit references to Tantric texts, and often saying that this particular observance is Tantric, with no particular value given to that, just as a contrast to Vedic. This is the Vedic way of doing Achamana, for example, and this is the Tantric way. But of course, this being nevertheless a Vaishnava text, we will not find any very transgressive elements of Tantra. The most shocking thing that we will find, and that may not be that shocking if there are any Tantra scholars here, is when constructing a temple. There's two ways given in the text for placating the divinities of the location where you want to build a temple. In one version, you're supposed to give them meat offerings, and you have to dress in black clothes, and whatever you're doing after the ritual, you have to get rid of that, the black clothes and whatever implements. But that's kind of the most transgressive you get. And even in this case, the author will then say, but you can also do it in a nicer way, vegetarian and so on. So we see some Veda, we see some Tantra in the text. But we still need to consider this question, why was it written? And I think an important point here is that this is one of the earliest texts of the Gaudiya Vaishnava movement. The earliest Sanskrit text probably being the Brihad Bhagavatamrita of Sanatana Goswamis. This following just a few years after that. This was a time when the tradition wasn't very strongly established yet in Vrindavana. We heard Rembert speak about this a couple of weeks back. There were many disciples of Chaitanya Dev in Vrindavan already. But there seems to have been a tendency to try to form links to other groups. This is very evident in the Haribhakti Vilasa. Many times the author will say that this particular thing, after he's given the general instructions for doing something, he will say, then you do it svasampradaya anusarata, following your own sampradaya, your own tradition. So he's not out to write a manual for a new religious movement. He's trying to write something that all the Vaishnavas in the Vraja area will benefit from. Nevertheless, he does bring in some new elements. And the most obvious element here is Chaitanya Deva, the founder of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. He's mentioned in the beginning of the book and in the beginning of every chapter. There's a verse dedicated to him, and sometimes other chapters in the middle of the chapter, some other verses in the middle of the chapters as well. However, there's not very much about Chaitanya Deva. One of the big 19th century scholars of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Sushil Kumar De, he made a lot out of this. That there's so little about Chaitanya in the book. He said that this shows how the Goswamis of Vrindavana were against this kind of deification of the founder that the Bengali followers very much like. But as Rembert showed us the other week, this doesn't hold true. Also not in this text. Chaitanya Deva is clearly deified in these verses given. However, there's not very much stress on him, and there's no description of any kind of ritual worship of him. There's no mention of his mantra or any kind of formal worship of him. Rather, he's the fountainhead of the teachings that the author is giving, and his param guru or grand guru, the guru of his own guru. The other question here, when looking at the contents of the book, which is maybe even more striking from the perspective of modern Gaudiya Vaishnavism, is the question of Radha. Because there's no mention, hardly any mention of Radha in the text. She is mentioned here and there, but for example, in describing how to establish an image of the Lord, there's nothing about establishing any Radha images. Even when the Shaktis of Vishnu are described, mentioned, Radha is not there. And this, of course, has surprised many Gaudiya Vaishnava readers. The commentator, though, does dwell at some length in a few places on Radha, but the main text doesn't. Again, I think we need to look at the history of the text. Today, it seems like one of the most basic things of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Even the cover of this printed edition of the Hari Bhakti Vilasa has a picture of the Jugal Murti, or the dual Murti of Radha and Krishna, even though there's no Radha and Krishna in the book. But it's such an obvious thing for Gaudiya Vaishnavism that they'll put it on the cover of even this book. Nevertheless, in 1540, all the Gaudiya Vaishnava temples in Vrindavan were temples of just Krishna. Madan Mohana, Govinda, Gopinatha, these temples, they just had the image of Krishna. The Radha images that are in these temples today came later. We heard about this from Rembert as well. There are different versions of how they exactly came, who sent them, who installed them. But the fact is that they're a little bit later. So the kind of Gaudiya Vaishnavism that we find in this book differs from later Gaudiya Vaishnavism in some ways, because the author wants to write for a large audience, but also because Gaudiya Vaishnavism in Vrindavan at that time simply looked different than the Gaudiya Vaishnavism that later authors describe. And this, of course, rather than being an oddity, makes this book interesting. Because if we kind of wade through all these mahatmyas, if we wade through all the details of the rituals, what we find is a very early articulation of the doctrines of Chaitanya Dev. For example, when the author said that non-Brahmins can sometimes be gurus, this is something that later Gaudiya Vaishnavas will pick up. And we find in later manuscripts in Bengal, they will add verses to that particular place. The manuscripts are unfortunately not very different from each other. It's not that there's extra chapters or a whole chapter on Radha or something like that. But nevertheless, there are some differences. And one difference is that when describing the guru, the Bengali manuscripts will add some verses. And one of those extra verses there will say that the Brahmin is the guru of the Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Shudras. But the Vaishnava Shudra is the guru of Brahmins, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas. So we see how this kind of small opening left in the text is then gradually made use of and enlarged, so that then the following generation of Gaudiya Vaishnavas, such as Narottama and Shamananda, who are not Brahmins, they would then claim the right to act as gurus. And today this is a discussion within the Sampradaya that is still alive, whether a guru needs to be a Brahmin or not. But in this text we can see an early articulation of these ideas. And looking more closely at this text, I believe, can help us to understand better the early stages of this tradition. Thank you very much.